Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 12. Dhruva Maharaj goes back to Godhead. Text 13.
Shat, Trimshad, Varsha, Sahasram, Shashasa, Shiti, Mandalam, Bogai, Punya, Shaya, Purvan, Abhoga, Ashubha, Shaya. Shatrim Shadvarsha Sahasram Shashasa Shiti Mandalam Bogai Punyakshayam Purvan Abogai Rashubakshayam Shatrim Shadvarsha Sahasram Shashasak Shiti Mandalam Bogai Punyakshayam Kurvan Abogara Shubakshayam Shatrim Shadvarsha Sahasram Shashasak Shiti Mandalam Bogai Punyakshayam Kurvan Abogai Rashubakshayam
Shat Shatrim Shat 36
Varsha
Years
Sahasram
Thousand
Shashasa
Ruled.
Shiti Mandalam,
the earth planet.
Bogai,
by enjoyment.
Punya,
of reactions of pious activities.
Kshayam,
diminution.
Kurvan,
doing.
Abogai,
by austerities.
Ashubha,
of inauspicious reactions.
Kshayam,
diminution. Translation. Dhruva Maharaj ruled over this planet for 36,000 years. He diminished the reactions of pious activities by enjoyment, and by practicing austerities, he diminished inauspicious reactions. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. That Dhruva Maharaj ruled over the planet for 36,000 years means that he was present in the Satya Yuga, because in the Satya Yuga, people used to live for 100,000 years. In the next Yuga, Treta, people used to live for 10,000 years. And in the next Yuga, Dwarapara, for 1,000 years. In the present age, the Kali Yuga, the maximum duration of life is 100 years. With the change of the yugas, the duration of life and memory, the quality of kindness, and all other good qualities diminish. There are two kinds of activities, namely pious and impious. By executing pious activities, one can gain facilities for higher material enjoyment, but due to impious activities, one has to undergo severe distress. A devotee, however, is not interested in enjoyment or affected by distress. When he's prosperous, he knows, I am diminishing the results of my pious activities. And when he's in distress, he knows, I am diminishing the reactions of my impious activities. A devotee is not concerned with enjoyment or distress. He simply desires to execute devotional service. It is said in Srimad Bhagavatam that devotional service should be apratihata, unchecked by the material conditions of happiness or distress. The devotee undergoes processes of austerity, such as observing Ekadasi and similar other fasting days, and refraining from illicit sex life, intoxication, gambling, and meat-eating. Thus, he becomes purified from the reactions of his past impious life, and because he engages in devotional service, which is the most pious activity, he enjoys life without separate endeavor. Translation. Dhruva Maharaj ruled over this planet for 36,000 years. He diminished the reactions of pious activities by enjoyment. And by practicing austerities, he diminished inauspicious reactions. Magyanatamarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuramilatulena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swami Bhagadamayam Dadati Swaparatikam Panchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Paditanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Vedanta Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Shishi Radha 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 Ki. We've been hearing the last 2 days about the quality of Dhruva Maharaj, qualities, and particularly yesterday we were hearing about his qualities as a ruler, very pious, Krishna-conscious ruler, Kshatriya ruler, and as such, he was able to help the citizens in all regards. Of course, he was able to give the ultimate help by encouraging Krishna consciousness in his kingdom, which was this planet. He was doing that. Plus also, he was encouraging people to improve materially with a view to ultimately becoming Krishna conscious by all sorts of other arrangements, proper arrangements for the functioning of the state in so many ways, and facilitating the execution of prescribed duties by the different varnas and ashrams in terms of the relative positions of the citizens. So, in various ways, as a Kshatriya ruler, he was ideal, and the social conditions, individually, collectively, everything was quite auspicious, fully auspicious. Everyone was advancing very progressively. So that was Satya Yuga, as Prabhupada mentions here. Dhruva Maharaj ruled for 36,000 years. So practically it could only have been Satya Yuga, because in Satya Yuga people can live for 100,000 years. And everything is very nice, naturally very nice. Everyone situated in the mode of goodness, very little influence from the lower modes of material nature. Even it's stated that at the beginning of Satya Yuga, at least at the beginning of Satya Yuga, before the material energy starts some deterioration, which finally ends, at least in terms of Satya Yuga, ends in entering into Treta Yuga. So at the beginning of Satya Yuga, things were so auspicious and so nice, everyone was so advanced, that sometimes it's described that there were not four ashrams. in Satyayuga, at least at the beginning. There was no real necessity for so much of this, these divisions of society in different ways. But mainly everyone was Paramahamsa. Essentially there was only one ashram, that was the Paramahamsa ashram. In other words, everyone was very, very advanced and quite detached materially. So conditions were like that. Satyayuga, by our standards, is very long. Something like 700,000 or years, something like that. Something along those lines. So, actually, seeing everyone as living 100,000 years, that means that in Satyayuga there are only a few generations, actually. There's only a few generations. And then before you know, you're in Satyayuga. But anyway, at the beginning, things were so very nice. Dhruva Maharaj was ruling at some point in the Satyayuga. Things were very nice. Conditions were very nice. But then gradually things deteriorated. There's some sense of proportion in the rate of deterioration from 100,000 to 10,000, the longevity, lifespan. 100,000 down to 10, down to 1, down to 100. And now, where is a 100-year-old person? There are not many. Very rare, actually. No one is really thinking, no one is really expecting to live 100 years. Average life expectancy, at least in the Western world, is 75 years. Slowly increasing, actually. Now it's approximately 75 years. In other parts of the world, less materially developed, 35 years. India, the life expectancy is approximately 35 years. So if you meet someone who's 40 years old, even though by Western standards they're not old, just in the middle of their lives, but by those standards, they're old because they're beyond the average lifespan. So, Kali Yuga, there's the sense of proportion. 100,000 years is a very long time to live. 10,000 years also to us seems very long. 1,000 years also seems very long. And when you're a child, 100 years seems long. But we know, as we feel time moving on, as one gradually is aging, then one realizes that actually this lifetime that we have, 70, 80 years, whatever, something like that, actually it's not very long at all. It's very, very short. The child has some illusory sense of eternality, or at least no expectancy of an end being there to the lifetime. But as the person gets a little older, particularly as they go beyond the halfway point, they realize that actually my life is not very long. So if things are deteriorating like that, there's the sense of proportion, and there's also a sense of proportion in the deterioration of the qualities. From 100% all good qualities in Satyayuga, at least at the beginning, 75% beginning of Treta Yuga, 50% at the beginning of Dwapara Yuga, 25% at the beginning of Kali Yuga, and then at the end, nothing. Actually, we see that practically nothing is left now. At the beginning of Kali Yuga, Srila Prabhupada explains that the only good quality that is really existing, not existing fully, but can be seen to some extent, the only good quality is a little truthfulness. Practically there's no mercy. Practically there's no austerity. Practically there's no cleanliness. But a little mercy, a little truthfulness is there. Not complete truthfulness. Just a little truthfulness is there. So much deterioration. Everything is deteriorating. From that point of everyone being situated on a very advanced level of material goodness and practically spiritual goodness, very advanced, things have deteriorated to this point. So, Prabhupada is explaining, and the verse is explaining, that Dhruva Maharaj, he was ruling, and conditions were so auspicious, and he was also situated very nicely in Krishna consciousness. He was also experiencing that whatever karma there may have been was diminishing. He was observing that happening. He was observing that sometimes I'm enjoying and sometimes I'm suffering. And as he observed the coming and going of this happiness and then distress and then some happiness and then some distress, he was observing that without being affected. And he was understanding that this is good, actually. The whole process is good. Because all my karma, whatever there may be, it's all being diminished. My good karma, my bad karma, it's all being diminished. So if I remain fully engaged in devotional service, then as time goes on, there'll be no karma. Simply devotional service. Simply the transcendental nature. Absorption in the transcendental nature. So, Dhruva Maharaj in this way was very exemplary as a devotee. This is a very advanced level of consciousness. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna begins his instruction to Arjuna by explaining marcha sparshas to Kunteya, satoshna sukha dukha da, agama payano vichas, tams titikshashva bharata. He's advising Arjuna to titikshava, that you tolerate. Learn to tolerate. In the next verse he says, Yamhina vyatiyantyete purusham purushashava samaduka sukham diram somratatvaya kalpate. That if a person learns to tolerate, not just the distress, generally people, if we think of tolerating, we think of tolerating distress. But in the first of those two verses, Lord Krishna says that a transcendentalist has to learn to tolerate distress and happiness and observe their coming and going without getting caught up in the process of trying to fight to hold on to the enjoyment and to fight to keep away the suffering, but just let it come and go. So Lord Krishna says that if a person learns to do this, learns this art of tolerance in Krishna consciousness, tolerating happiness and distress, understanding it's simply my karma, in the same way that Dhruva Maharaj is understanding. Then in the second of the two verses, Lord Krishna says, he becomes qualified for liberation. This is one fundamental characteristic of the process of yoga. Process of yoga. There are so many different types of yogas. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes a number of them. Jnana yoga, Sankhya yoga, Karma yoga, Dhyana yoga, which is part of Ashtanga yoga, then Bhakti yoga. Other types of yogas are also referred to in the 8th chapter, Shat Chakra yoga. Different types of yogas. But what is the underlying principle? The underlying principle is that through yoga, one can learn to tolerate the difficulties of material nature, become fixed on the transcendental platform, and become liberated. Of course, in Bhakti yoga, we understand that there is a higher principle also, that is to please Krishna by engaging in his devotional service. But still, it follows that if one is engaged nicely like that, that in the course of becoming absorbed in pure devotional service, liberation comes also. And that tolerating in this spirit is also a part of bhakti yoga. It's also a part. One has to learn that out. So right there at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains this fundamental underlying principle which applies in all processes of yoga, that you have to learn to tolerate your distresses and your happinesses and not become caught up identifying with either and in this way becoming entangled. So this is very important for a devotee. Very important. This very nice example, at least of tolerance of distress, very nice example given in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Maharaj Parikshit is touring his kingdom and he comes upon the personality of Kali, mercilessly beating and actually trying to kill the personality of religion, who's in the form of a bull. Already Kali has viciously severed three of the four legs of the bull and is hard at work on the fourth, which is truthfulness. Hard at work, and the poor bull, personality of religion, is in very terrible condition, actually. So, Maharaj Parikshit, we know the account. Maharaj Parikshit, he intervenes very strongly. But even though he knows exactly what is the situation, still for the sake of executing the process of justice, which is part of dharma, part of the one of the principles of dharma for a king, so he holds a little trial on the spot, and he asks Dharma, who did this? Of course, he already saw who did it, but he asks, who did this? And of course, one might expect, if one is on the material platform and such a thing is happening to oneself, one would expect that the personality that you would say, oh, it was him. But Dharma, the personality of religion, he doesn't give some specific answer like that. He suggests certain possibilities, but then he says, actually, no one has done this. No one's really done it to me. But it's just the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, no one should be punished. Why should someone be punished? So Srila Prabhupada explains very nicely in one of the purports there that the personality of religion was under attack, and we also, sometimes some difficulty comes inevitably from time to time. In one way or another, some interpersonal conflict, health, the threefold miseries of material existence. So these are coming and going. And how are they coming and going? Simply according to our karma. That's all. Simply according to our karma. So Srila Prabhupada explains, in the context of the personality of religion statement, that no one is really responsible for this, it's just the will of the Lord. Prabhupada explains that we have already created our happiness and distress by our previous activities. So, in this case, distress was there. Distress was there. So, if we, when we're subjected to distress, if we identify that my distress is coming from this, the apparent immediate cause, the person who's attacking me, or whatever the conditions that may be that we're facing. Prabhupada makes the point that he who identifies the criminal is as guilty as the criminal. In other words, if Dharma had said it was him, Kali, he's at fault. He's to blame and he should be punished because I'm innocent. And when someone attacks an innocent person, they must be punished. So Prabhupada says that he who identifies the criminal is as guilty as the criminal. Because why is that person actually suffering that distress? As a direct reaction for some sinful activity in the past. So actually that the person who's undergoing the distress is guilty of causing his own distress due to his previous sinful activity. In other words, he only has himself to blame. And by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, his reactions are coming. So a devotee, this is a very advanced level of consciousness in material life. Everyone is completely fixed in the idea that when success comes, it's because of me, because I'm very qualified. And when distress comes, it's a disaster. And probably, generally, I'm not to blame, but I'm just the innocent victim, because how could I be to blame? Such a nice person as me. So, this is material consciousness. And when we come to Krishna consciousness, we come, but our consciousness takes some time coming. The body may be there going through the motions, rendering devotional service, but the consciousness, so many habits are there, so much conditioning is there, and only in time, how much time depends on, in one sense, how sincerely the devotee applies himself or herself to the process. But generally we can see through our experience that time is there. And if one works seriously, then gradually these fundamental concepts of Krishna conscious philosophy can become a reality, and we can actually, our lives can be simply going on in those terms. But before we come to that platform, as we slowly come to that platform, when these things happen, happiness, distress, our tendency may be there to identify, become affected like that. So we should try to develop this jnana chakshus or shastra chakshus, seeing through the eyes of knowledge, seeing through the eyes of scripture. Just like we read in various of our literatures, some great devotee is expressing that I'm in a very fallen condition. I don't have good qualities, actually I have many bad qualities. And lamenting like that. So this is very advanced consciousness. This type of consciousness can only really come as the devotee realizes that whatever happiness, whatever distress is coming to me on the material platform, this is due to my previous activities. So we have to cultivate this consciousness. On the other hand, we have the example of Dhruva Maharaj. He's an example of a person to whom some great happiness came. The benediction offered by the Supreme Lord. You can have a vast kingdom if you want. But he didn't identify. He understood, actually, I must stick to Krishna consciousness. So we have to cultivate this. By cultivating pure devotional service, by cultivating the attitude of service to the Supreme Lord, understanding that I am simply an instrument in the hands of the Lord. So let me just take that position. Let me have that type of understanding of myself. Let me just act like that. By acting, cultivating this mood of pure devotional service, then gradually these good qualities come, or this realization comes of these philosophical points. And as one gradually comes to realize these philosophical points, gradually one becomes able to deal with the results of one's pious activities when they come, and the results of one's impious activities when they come. So this is very important. Prabhupada refers to one verse in Srimad Bhagavatam in the second chapter of the first canto, Savaikum sam paro dharmo. Yato bhaktiya hoksajaya, ahaita ki apratam. If it's to actually be satisfied, we are practicing Krishna consciousness, and at least for one who's neophyte, then, because of different circumstances, happiness will be there. Sometimes the devotee will be very happily engaged. Other times the devotee, the mind will drift away, enthusiasm will go. So why is this happening? Because the devotee has not come to this platform of being fully absorbed in devotional service, unmotivated devotional service, uninterrupted devotional service. The devotee is still identifying on the material platform with my happiness or my distress. So by cultivating this mood that I am the eternal servant of Krishna, that is my position, that is my business in life, I have no other business trying to cultivate happiness or sidestep distress. My only business is to go on and on executing devotional service faithfully and understanding that the happiness and distress which comes to me is coming from my previous karma, and just tolerating that and not allowing it to interfere with one's execution of devotional service, then one can advance very nicely. So this is a very important thing for all devotees to try to cultivate. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Tatena kampam susamikshamano punjana evata kritam vipakam, that the devotee goes on executing devotional service in this spirit, always offering obeisances to the Lord from the core of their heart, always fully engaged, and when the reactions come, understanding where they're coming from and tolerating them, happiness and distress. Then Krishna says, Jivati yo mukti pade sadayabhak. For such a devotee, the kingdom of God becomes their rightful inheritance. It becomes their rightful property. Srila Prabhupada, in explaining that verse, he said, it means inheritance, just like in the sense of a child inheriting from the father. What does the child have to do in order to inherit from the father? He doesn't have to do anything great, Prabhupada explains. All he has to do is stay alive. That's all. As long as he doesn't die. He doesn't have to put on some grand performance to please the father. It'll come. It'll simply come. Naturally. All he has to do is stay alive. Or in other words, all the devotee has to do is stick in Krishna consciousness. Just stick at the lotus feet of the Lord. Understanding one's position in these terms. And if one sticks at Krishna's lotus feet, always rendering devotional service faithfully, in a humble mood, not being affected by the fluctuations of material nature on the basis of one's karma, then Krishna will give everything by this dedicated devotional service. The kingdom of God will become the devotee's rightful inheritance in due course of time. Some comments. Of course, one other little point that Prabhupada's mentioning here, that the austerities which devotees naturally follow, like following the four regulative principles and Ekadasi, today of course is Ekadasi, everyone should remember that. So the austerities which the devotees naturally follow, they're burning up the previous simple reactions, because austerity means a little difficulty. So on this Ekadasi day, we should remember that, perform our little tapasya, minimum tapasya to avoid grains and legumes, at least do that. One can also fast completely. Srila Jiva Goswami in Bhakti Sandhava, he gives a very interesting description of the duties of a Vaishnav on Ekadasi. He says that, of course, in due course of time it appears to have been modified a little, at least by Srila Prabhupada, but He said that there's no real question of Ekadasi if you eat or sleep. He said actually the ideal standard is you don't sleep the night before, you stay up chanting. You don't eat, of course, on the Ekadasi day. And then the following night you also don't sleep. 2 nights in a row. The next day after the Ekadasi, you may eat some very small amount. Very small. And then the next night, you can take some rest. And he's very insistent, actually, that this is the way that Ekadasi is really to be followed. Of course, we know Srila Prabhupada also modified that, and that his modification is valid and bona fide. But the opportunity is here. Minimum little austerity is there. Of course, we're automatically following four regulative principles. Minimum little austerity is there. One can also accept more if one wants. But the essence is be fully engaged in devotional service, particularly hearing and chanting. In this way, gain positive transcendental benefit. So any comments or questions? We have a couple of announcements. So Srila Bhakti Churi Maharaj is having a darshan this evening at 6:30 at Jagadananda Prabhu's place in Reservoir Hills. Everyone is welcome. And His Holiness Giriraj Maharaj is also having a darshan in the temple here in Srila Prabhupada's room, also at 6:30. So everyone is welcome to attend those two programs. Things within devotional service are different. Just mundane happiness and distress. One day you're sick. Next day you feel, or some day later you feel very invigorated. So on the material platform, the devotee isn't going to hanker or isn't going to be particularly happy or sad. The devotee will understand, this is just my karma. Let me execute devotional service in some suitable way under the circumstances and carry on. The devotee may gain some money, some inheritance or gift or something may come. The devotee doesn't become happy materially thinking, oh, now I'm going to gratify my senses. And if the next day someone steals the money, the devotee doesn't become sad thinking, now I can't gratify my senses, like I was thinking of. On the devotional platform, the devotee may think, oh, now I can do so much service to the Lord with this money. And if the money is stolen, then the devotee may lament, oh, I wanted to render some service, buy something for the deities or whatever, but now I can't. But that's different, that's quite different. So certainly on the mundane platform, material platform, the devotee has to cultivate this ability actually through full engagement in devotional service and philosophical understanding of not becoming affected by these personal material occurrences which are coming from one's karma and to always remain engaged in devotional service whatever the material circumstances may be. So another comment or question? Jagat Guru Prabhu?
How you say that people
Yes. Well, that's staying alive in Krishna consciousness. You have to stay spiritually alive. Sitting in the temple room. Nothing. No, it means one has to stay alive spiritually. One has to just stay in Krishna consciousness. That's all. And if one dies in Krishna consciousness, so to speak, in other words, if one falls down from Krishna consciousness, then that condition is, one has failed to meet the condition of staying alive spiritually. Of course, the devotee naturally, as the devotee is, so to speak, staying alive in Krishna consciousness by following the program and doing the things which devotees are meant to do, then naturally the devotee becomes inspired to do more rather than just hang in there so you avoid looping. The devotee actually becomes enlightened. Let me render service. Let me render more service. Let me learn more about Krishna consciousness. This comes naturally, but the fundamental, basic, essential thing which has to be there is the devotee at least has to stay alive in Krishna consciousness. At least follow the basic program and remain in the association of devotees. The question is that sometimes we see, or that one who's on the Brahma-Buddha platform is not meant to become disturbed, but sometimes we see that devotees, sometimes they're blissful, sometimes they're disturbed. Well, when you're speaking of advanced devotees, if you're speaking about including neophyte devotees, sometimes neophyte devotees will become disturbed for some material reason. But if you're talking about advanced devotees, then even when they're disturbed, they're in ecstasy. Yes. The topmost example, of course, of that is Srimati Radharani, who said that if my unhappiness pleases Krishna, then my unhappiness becomes my greatest happiness. So from the material point of view, it doesn't make sense. But on a deeper, internal, from the spiritual point of view, even when the devotees are separated from Krishna, very, very advanced devotees, they may be separated from Krishna, and externally, they're lamenting in so many ways, but actually, they're very blissful in Krishna consciousness. Yes. That's the nature of Krishna consciousness. Even that separation and that the lamentation and so on which is involved enhances the ecstasy, which is a little inconceivable from the material platform. Thinking of his mother rather than thinking of Krishna. Is that what you mean? And not Krishna. Is that what you said? Yeah.
He thought
of his
mother. Yeah.
Yes. Thinking of Krishna alone includes thinking of his devotees. So his mother had acted as a devotee. and he was thinking of her in as she had acted as a devotee. There's not so much of a description of his mother and, you know, like her personal qualities, but at least in that context, at least, she was acting as a devotee. At least. And she may have been a great devotee. Young. I don't know. I don't think it's really described so much, but at least in that context, she was acting as a devotee. He was thinking of her like that. So it didn't contradict. And how she helped him to become Krishna conscious, and how it had all led now to this, going back to Godhead. So in that way, it was very nice. And it helped his mother also. She went back to Godhead. If his wife is, the question is, interesting question, husband and wife devotees, if the husband dies thinking of his wife, who's a devotee, then is that the same? Well, if she's a very nice advanced devotee, and if he's thinking of her in a very devotional spirit, then, you know, of course in these material, I mean in these relationships, there are prone to be material elements. Yeah. I mean there are material elements, but we try to engage them in devotional service. So therefore some danger is there, there's no doubt. Yeah. But if actually the relationship is spiritual, truly spiritual, and then the husband is like the spiritual master, and that means that the wife is like a disciple, actually. And if she's really a very advanced and fixed up disciple, then... Am I right, Maharaj? That's a good comment.
We never find in any of our literature a recommendation that a man...
Right, that's a very good and sobering comment. Yes. Any other comment or question? Good health. A devotee needs good health. Good health to do service. So how do you apply tolerance if a devotee doesn't have good health? I was reading an essay by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He was saying that bad health is not at all necessarily a disturbance or a hindrance to the execution of pure devotional service. It may affect the type of devotional service that you do. You may desire to do some service which takes a lot of physical energy. So due to bad health, you may not be able to do that. You may be confined to bed, perhaps, if you're extremely unwell. But still you can be Krishna conscious. Still you can be Krishna conscious. And you should understand, this is my karma. By the arrangement of Krishna, it's come to this on the material platform. My body is in this condition. So now in this condition, let me find some way to render devotional service wholeheartedly. Like that. Okay, I think we'll end there. Oh, Dr. Jones.
And you were saying earlier how for instance Srimati Radharani, when she was externally appearing to be in distress, internally she was very ecstatic. And because you're reading from the first letter where Mother Kunti, she's praying that she always put in distress.
Yes, Queen Kunti in her prayers in the 8th chapter of the first canto, she prays that we've been put in so many distressful conditions, And actually, I would like those types of things to happen again and again. Because when distress comes, I remember you. I see you. And when I see you, then I don't have to see repeated birth and death. So that's very advanced. A very advanced level of Krishna consciousness. And actually, Srila Jiva Goswami gives a very interesting explanation of this, like, apparent conflict between the distress of a devotee and the bliss of the devotee simultaneously, the very advanced devotees. He says, he explains, this is in Preeti Sandarbha, he explains that what is the happiness of a devotee? The happiness of a devotee comes when the devotee pleases Krishna. So Krishna is pleased with the devotee. Therefore, the devotee becomes happy, which is like a reflection of the happiness which Krishna is experiencing through that service of the devotee. Therefore, the devotee is very happy because Krishna is happy, actually as part of like the interaction between them, reciprocation from Krishna. Now, if what makes Krishna happy is that the devotee, it serves in separation, then if the devotee tries to be close to Krishna, it won't please Krishna, so the devotee won't feel that happiness. Because Krishna won't be pleased, so the devotee won't be sharing that pleasure of Krishna, even though the devotee is right with Krishna. But if the devotee is separate from Krishna, and that is what Krishna wants, and Krishna is pleased, the devotee will be very blissful inside. Through that, he describes it as a reflection of the bliss of Krishna. But the devotee within their own mind will be thinking, oh, I'm separate from Krishna, how distressing. So in this way, the two components are there. Bliss is there through pleasing Krishna, but on another level, in another way, distress is there at the same time. Srila Prabhupada Kirtan.